Hi there. Thank you for joining me on this conversation. My name is Rue, and I'm a senior associate at Winkworth Sherwood's Charities and Social Enterprises team. This is our inaugural episode of the series where we will be having informal and informative discussions with various representatives of the third sector, as well as with experts like my guest today to explore current developments in this sector. I am absolutely delighted and honoured to kick off this series with our guest, William Hopkin, who is a barrister at New Square Chambers. Will has been advising charities for over 20 years and has a wealth of experience, advising clients that range from national charities, universities, to specialist organisations and ancient foundations. So, Will, a deepest welcome to this conversation. It is an honour to have you here today.
Oh, that's very kind of you. I'm really looking forward to chatting.
Perhaps it'd be nice to kick off our conversation today if you would perhaps share with us on how you became a barrister specialising in the charity sector, and what advice would you give to aspiring barristers wanting to work and specialise in this area of law?
Well, I'm delighted to talk about myself for a moment. I guess about 15 to 20 years ago, I made a conscious decision that I would like to practice in relation to charities. But there's a bit of a journey on both sides of that. So I started out, Oxford is my hometown, even though I practice in London. And I started out as a teenager volunteering for Oxfam. And then as I went into my 20s, I took on a range of different volunteer roles. Eventually, I suppose you could say, moving up to being a trustee. My first trustee engagement was with a advocacy charity for people with learning disabilities. It's a great charity. And by this stage, I was working as a barrister, but not in charities work. I was doing mostly asylum, human rights and criminal law, but I wasn't really satisfied with sort of that getting to the root of the social issues. So I had a bit of a change and left working as a barrister and set up a social enterprise. Haven't got time to do that now, but if you invite me back, I will be able to discuss that further. But eventually I went back into law for family reasons, made a conscious decision to make a start. But I must say, it take 5 or 10 years to build up the necessary expertise and contacts to be able to practice at a good level.
I see. And what advice would you give? I guess it's quite a broad question, isn't it? To aspiring barristers wanting to specifically specialise in what is quite a niche area, isn't it, of law?
It is indeed. I think if I could start with something that would sound like a negative, in that when you start out, there's not really enough work as a junior barrister in the charities area, it being a niche area, and there being a number of barristers that specialise in that. But I see that as a positive in that you can build up experience in overlapping areas, so trusts, companies, contracts, and wills, for example, which will be valuable later when you're tackling a higher level of charities work. Also, knowing that it's a bit of a slow burn, that takes some stress away from it too, in that you can just get involved in ways that you want. I mean, becoming a trustee is really very helpful in being able to give, not only is it a great thing to do, but also to be able to give some rounded advice. And similarly, there are always volunteering opportunities, charities needing help with basic documents or contracts, and just getting stuck into the field, learning as much as you can. So it's an exciting start, but I think it takes a reasonable amount of time to build up sort of proper work.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective. And actually, just picking on what you said earlier, well, we actually share a very similar entry into charities because as a teenager myself, my first voluntary role was actually at Oxfam as well. It was a
Right.
Oxfam, yeah, charity shop in Cardiff, actually. And I then moved on to work in centres for adults with learning disabilities. So I can see very interesting parallels. And I was actually interviewed, oh gosh, it's probably a year and a half ago by a TV network, People on Work, asking specifically about how do you become a charities lawyer? Because there's this question mark over because it's such a niche area. So, and like with yourself, I recommend volunteering as a way as to gain insight into the day-to-day reality of the job. Because as as charity advisors, we're not only technical experts in the area of law, we are also commercial advisors. So I think to gain that commercial experience, it's really invaluable to be a trustee of charity, as you say, or volunteer in another capacity on the board of a charity or on the executive committee of a charity. So
Yeah.
definitely very much share that sort of insight you've provided.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, and you and I actually met at the New Square Chambers annual charities conference, I think it was last year, and we've since collaborated on a separate project together, looking at the changes brought by the New Charities Act 2022.
Indeed.
Would you like to give an overview, perhaps, of some of the important changes that have come in recently? And are there any changes that plan changes that have been delayed in coming into force?
Yes, so the charity having a sort of new Charities Act sounds very grand and sort of important, but I think the thing to remember in relation to Charities Act 2022 is it's mostly tinkering with the existing law to make it better in places. So there's no, I wouldn't say radical changes, but by and large, I think what's been brought in is helpful and impactful in terms of the sector. So in terms of what came in last autumn, if I just fo perhaps focus on two of the bigger ticket items, the first, and there may be some trustees listening and watching to this production, is changes in relation to payment of trustees. So the rules in relation to paying trustees for services. So that might be a trustee who's an accountant who will do some bookkeeping for the charity or providing IT advice. The rules in relation to services are now being expanded in relation to paying trustees for goods. So that might be, for example, sending a porter cabin to a charity or IT equipment or something like that. Thing is, still to remember though that there are best value rules in place to protect the charity and also to ensure that there aren't conflicts of interest. And before you just press ahead and go ahead with this, remember the governing document is key. It needs to be allow for this in order for the changes to be utilised. And the second is important in relation to charities that do fundraising appeals. And the rules in this regard have thankfully been simplified so that if you've raised too much money and the amount at stake is less than £1,000, then it may be possible just to press ahead and use it for the charity's purposes if you've got a good plan about that. If it's more than that, rules about getting charity commission approval have been simplified. And there are also new simplified rules if you haven't. Fundraise, you haven't got enough raised enough. Oh, you meant sorry, you mentioned as well. I think yes, there was one provision that was going to come in was trustees making payments where there's a moral obligation to do so, but they're legally obliged to.
Ex gratia payments.
Yeah, ex gratia payments and those. Quite often occur in a sort of wills context where there's a disappointed family member. But there was a concern on behalf of the government that it might these rules might have unexpected consequences in relation to museums who've obtained artifacts from countries overseas. And these changes have been pulled back until that's been thought through more.
Yeah. Indeed, there's a couple of articles written about that, wasn't there, on the museum piece. So we wait with bated breath on whether that will resurface. But certainly, the seminal changes you pointed out just now, formed part of the first phase of changes that have come in last autumn. And we are expecting this cohort, the second batch of changes, come in really any time now onwards. We are in spring. So we await changes. And thankfully, we've got some relaxation of rules around charity and disposal of charity property coming into force, which is helpful. And one of my personal favourites is some changes around permanent endowment rules and relaxation so that trustees are able to, for instance, spend a certain portion of their permanent endowment. So it's well worth checking the details around that, which I will provide in the show notes to this discussion, with a useful implementation plan as well. And then the last phase due to come in autumn this year, and that will look at harmonisation of charity constitutions, on changing charity constitutions to hopefully simplify the process, and some useful rules around enumeration of charity trustees and charity mergers. So we await those tranche of changes in autumn of this year. So, Will, I also want to take this opportunity to share some other notable updates in the charity sector, if I may. You may have seen that there's a new trustee charity commission account sort of floating around.
I wasn't aware of this. Tell me more.
Yeah, so this was a platform that was sort of designed and touted at last year's October Charity Commission AGM, where I actually attended. And they're essentially rolling out an online platform for trustees to access online services more easily. So trustees themselves will each get an account with the Charity Commission. And it's really part of the Charity Commission's drive to foster deeper relationships with trustees, and in the long run, to hopefully keep charity trustees informed, depending on the area of charity, the type of charity the trustees volunteer at. So they will receive tailored advice from the Charity Commission. Of course, I act for a lot of charities whose trustee board are towards the more elderly demographic. And some trustees, as you can imagine, just simply do not have access to a computer, or who are digitally illiterate. So I basically asked the charity commissioners, what about those trustees? Will this create a problem where certain trustees will be more informed than others? They replied by effectively saying, for trustees that do not have access to a computer or who are not digitally literate, their charity commission contact centre will still be the primary point of contact for charity trustees. So it remains to be seen how this is going to work in practice, but I'm happy to at least see that they've thought about these class of trustees who do not have access to a computer. Alongside this, last week I saw that there's going to be a new charity commission guidance on investments coming out. And the Charity Commission are currently road testing this with a sample of charity trustees. And I think this is in line with, at the moment, we are, at the time of this recording at least, we're going through a cost of living crisis. So resource management, charity finances are one of the priority areas for the Charity Commission to help charity trustees to manage their charity. So this investment guidance that they're going to produce will hopefully be a more simplified, more accessible, easily digestible, I guess, version of the current investment guidance, which I don't know if you've read recently, Will, but it is very lengthy and very wordy. But I think also importantly, this particular investment guidance will also reflect the judgment from quite a seminal case from last year, the Butler-Sloss judgment, which really confirmed that trustees have a wide discretion in making investment decisions. For example, deciding to exclude certain investments based on non-financial considerations, but by the same token, they confirmed that trustees could just focus on financial return. So this more streamlined investment guidance will also clarify that judgment in that case as well. So I await to see the final product, but I will provide, as I say, a link to this roadmap that the Charity Commission has in mind for this investment guidance in my show notes. And I guess, given that we're given we're on the topic of managing finances with the current climate. I also saw, Will, that CAF has an online hub, quite a useful resource hub. I went through some of the content to help charity trustees free of charge on financial planning, on governance, on strategy. It also included quite useful content on how to write a grant, how to successfully write a grant for charities. So it's well worth checking that out as well.
I'm going to check that out because I haven't had a look at that.
Yeah, it is very useful and very user friendly, and I really enjoyed looking through the content. So yeah. Perhaps at this juncture, Will, if I could ask you, and I'm personally intrigued to find out since we last spoke, whether you've worked on any interesting cases you'd like to share with us.
Yes, also I need to be a little bit tactful in terms of names and so on, but I think I could certainly share the outline of a couple, because they've got some potentially quite good learning points of viewers. So I've just finished advising on a dispute between rival factions for the control of a temple. So that is who are the properly elected trustees, who can vote in the elections, were the elections fair? And things can get really tense in this respect. And the charity and its work suffer accordingly. And what came across on this case and a number of other cases in the similar sets of facts that I do is firstly that change is good in charities, and that having a fresh, still not life experienced board is helpful. Communication with members, if it's a members charity, is so important so that they feel engaged, know that the trustees got the interests of the charity at heart, and just abreast of what's going on. And I think finally, in terms of the charity's governing documents, if it's not up to date, including elections, this is a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
Because if the elections aren't conducted in accordance with the governing documents, even though that's what everyone's been doing for a while, then there are going to be disputes. They are going to get entrenched, and it's going to become a dispute of a legal nature as well, which is just what you don't need when you're trying to put out there some great services. So that was one. And I've relatively recently completed an engagement as an independent investigator for a national animal charity in relation to whistleblowing concerns. So I had to interview staff and trustees. I had to collect documents, and then I had to write put together an investigation report, which ran to almost the length of a short novel, setting out findings and recommendations. I think it was a valuable experience, I hope, for the charity involved and also myself. But what that told me is that you've really got to work hard at relationships within charities. And if they are starting to break down, and inevitably in any organization that will happen from time to time, you need to have the policies and procedures in place to be able to deal with that, whether that's workplace mediation, some other sort of conciliation, giving people an opportunity to explain their perspectives, and so can still work together, and the organization can function properly even if there is that conflict there. And then finally, and this is getting a little bit more technical, but you mentioned earlier about charity land and the new rules coming up in relation, or some tweaks to the laws in relation to that. I've had a few cases recently that have turned into disputes where the charity has sold land, but it hasn't complied with the rules that are in place there to protect getting best value. And up until relatively recently, it's been thought that even technical infringements of the rules would mean that the transaction would be void, and some of the protections for innocent purchasers applied. But more recently, there's been a case called the David Roberts Art Foundation, in which the courts have taken a more flexible approach to say that provided the substance of the rules has been follow, that is aimed at best value, technical infringements won't necessarily cause too much by way of problems.
Oh,
So.
that's actually very illuminating to know. And you mentioned best value, even post the changes that are about to come in any moment now on disposal rules, that still remains in place. That best value consideration of the trustees do not change, though there is more flexibility now. The trustees do not need to get a RIP appointed surveyor to provide what that guidance should look like. So that's they could essentially get advice even actually from a trustee themselves if they were if it, they were of a suitable had the suitable skill set to be advising the charity. Well, I also want to touch on your first case on the constitutional change. What's interesting there is that charities, in my experience, some trustees are not even aware that it's a membership charity. I don't know where you come across that more generally, because as sometimes trustees themselves are members of charities, but it can be quite confusing conceptually for people to sort of grapple with. And a lot of charities, smaller charities, the trustees are the members. So there's certainty there. But for charities that have a wider membership pool, we've got different types of people. And good governance really dictates that charities should be reviewing their constitution every 2 years just to make sure, A, there's no mission drift, B, they can still deliver the objects, the purpose of the charity. But these things can easily get sort of put aside, especially for charities that are a bit older, that have been around the mill. So I definitely recommend for a review exercise at least to look at periodically the constitution, especially the objects clause. And well, are you able to share how that dispute came to light? Is it because of lack of clarity in the constitution of that particular charity, or how did the dispute come to rise in the first place?
If I might say, you're going to get some pure legal disputes where there's a sort of genuine uncertainty about the governing documents and so on. But most disputes are relationship based. So when there's been a breakdown in relations, then there's an opportunity to perhaps channel arguments through an ambiguous constitution or an out of date constitution. And that's quite often what happens. So even though there's a strong legal angle to lots of disputes, it's usually relationships and a breakdown in those that's at the heart of it.
That's a very insightful comment there. On relationships, then, as I mentioned at the beginning, I guess our relationship started when we first met at the conference, charity annual charities conference, organised by New Square Chambers. And I believe by the time this recording goes out in the public domain, you would have had your current annual charities conference. Could you give us a flavour then of what one can expect if one were to attend the conference for future years?
Yes, definitely. I would just say as well that even though being barristers, we primarily deal with solicitors rather than charities and trustees directly. So the conference is primarily aimed at solicitor contacts and colleagues and friends. But if you're viewing and you'd like to come along, you most definitely can. But Benny, I'll tell you about it before people decide whether they might like to come along in their future years. So every year on an afternoon in the spring, Chambers organises 5 to 6 talks, and they bring together the latest developments across all areas of law that can affect charities. So it's not just charity governance. So you might have property, as we've been discussing. Insolvency, companies, legacies. Last year we had an entertaining talk on cryptos, which you may remember. I normally, because I do some of the organisation, give a 30-minute roundup of what's happened in the charity world in the past year. try to, as most speakers do, trying to keep it sort of reasonably light-hearted whilst being informative as well. So it's a 2 or 3 hours once a year, but it's just a good opportunity to connect out into the charity law community.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess my experience, that's how we met. It led to another project we worked on that I mentioned earlier as well, also with like-minded professionals. So it's really a great networking opportunity, as well as being very informative. And the kind of pays that were provided, let's not forget to mention Will, was excellent last year. So
Thank you.
that's definitely an added bonus. On
Great.
that note, Will, thank you so much for sparing your time and for coming along. For those watching at home, I hope you found our discussion in both informative and hopefully it's informal in nature. And we hope to catch you in our next episode. Many thanks. Bye.